Welcome, Father.
Well, thank you, Teresa. Good to be back.
It's good to have you here on this beautiful, gorgeous, sunny afternoon.
Yes.
I feel like we're in the middle of summer.
Practically, I think it's almost 80 degrees out.
Yeah, I think I saw 83 as I was heading in.
Gracious. Wow.
Well, what are we going to talk about today, Father?
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to go back to Rome.
All right, we're going back to Rome, okay.
We have spent about a month in Avignon.
Yes, we have.
As nice as it was, it's time to get back to work, as Catherine of Siena would have said.
So that would say, I know who's going to be instrumental in this.
Yes, definitely. You know, I thought about this program together, and I realized, I came to the conclusion that basically this return to Rome is about a saint and about a pope.
Okay.
And then afterwards, the rest of this program is going to be about a bunch of cardinals who were all wanted to be pope, and none of them were saints.
Oh, okay.
So with that,
I guess where we're going there.
Yes, right. Well, ultimately, this leads to a very unfortunate period of church history called the Western Schism, a time in which there were two, and at one time even three, popes. And so what we're looking at is the setup of how that came about, and the controversy that takes place.
Okay.
It's one of these deals of one of the good things behind studying church history is that when you see how bad it was at certain parts, you kind of realize that even with all the turmoil and trials that we go through today, that's nothing in comparison. That's a good lesson in history for us.
That's right.
We're looking at Pope Gregory the 11th.
Okay.
Okay, the last of the Avignon popes. And he was certainly an enthusiastic individual. He was had an intense zeal for the faith, and at the same time, very much interested in rooting out heresy. We have to remember again that we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, about these heresies that were running around southern France, the Cathars, the Albigensians, the Walensians, and their very weird ideas. And keep that in perspective. Keep in perspective that they were sort of the Jones. Remember that Jones situation.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Jones people, the Waco, Texas kind of David Koresh people of their day. So sometimes we look at this and go, oh, why didn't the popes? You know, why didn't they have greater religious tolerance? Well, the kind of things that were going on among these breakaway groups, especially in southern France and in Italy, you would not want, and any civil society would not want to just let that go and not confront the evil in that society. And certainly he did. One of the things he did was he helped to rebuild the Dominicans. They had been devastated by the bubonic plague of 1348. And so he helped to rebuild them again as an order, and then sent them off to southern France to preach and to bring back the people to the Catholic Church. This particularly in the areas around Dauphiny and Provence, down in the southern part of France, around what is now the French Riviera area there, in Lyonnais. And with that was introduced the Inquisition tribunals. There was a lot of support by the new French king. This is King Charles V. And so in the midst of all of this, you do have a raucous period of time in which the stake, the sword, prisons are commonly used. And it was kind of a no-holds-barred kind of a thing. In fact, it got so serious, there were so many arrests, that at one point in that part of France, they had a special collection in churches in order to pay for the food for the prisoners.
Wow.
It was that taxing. In Aragon, in Spain, you had an Inquisition that was investigating Jewish converts who had relapsed. It's known as the conversos. You're going to, several times in Spanish history, you'll come across this. There's also another group called the Moriscos. These are Moors, Muslims, who, at least on the surface, converted to Christianity. But this is a time in which there's a lot of talk about sorcery. If you remember, John the 22nd was there was an assassination attempt through sorcery against him. So these things were very much going on. And Pope Gregory was instrumental in routing this stuff out. And the same thing is also true in Portugal as well. In Italy, particularly in Sicily, he targets the Fraticelli. There's still some of these breakaway Franciscans who are still trying to impose universal poverty on
right.
everybody. So there's still some of that. There's also a problem with Jewish converts in Italy, in which some converted in name only, but not totally. And then in Germany, you've got some unique situations due to the bubonic plague. There's a whole group of people that follow after, and they're quite violent, called the flagellants. And these are mainly men,
okay.
and what they do is they beat themselves
mm-hmm.
in order to cause God to relent and take away the plague, and they went from city to city. They were quite violent, very interesting. And then there's a whole other group of lay people, much like the poor men of Lyon,
mm-hmm.
And they're called the Beghards. And once again, that's a group within Germany also that not only embraces radical poverty but also tries to impose that on everybody else.
Okay.
And so there's a millenarianist kind
mm-hmm.
of movement.
Mm-hmm.
And Gregory did a lot, the beginning of his pontificate, did a lot to confront those kinds of movements.
Great.
And all. Yeah. Well, of course, but he's best known for bringing the church back to, bringing the papacy back to Rome. And that's all very interesting in itself, because remember the reason why they did not go to Rome to begin with
mm-hmm.
and they stayed away from Rome for 70 something years is because Italy was a mess.
Right, and the families fighting in Italy. And
exactly
mm-hmm.
right. And Gregory knew that before he could go back to Rome, he would have to do something about that.
Okay.
And one of the things he did was he took the bad boy of Italy and took him to task. This man by the name of Bernardo Visconti. Now, the Visconti family is throughout much of Italian history, central Italy, the area around Milan, very, very powerful. Even during the Renaissance, a couple hundred years later, Gian Galeazzo Visconti is just going to be a very powerful force to deal with. And so here we have, in central, north central Italy.
Okay.
And so here we have the Pope using his diplomatic skills to isolate Visconti from the other families, and also isolate in the same time the city of Florence and the Florentine League.
Okay.
And so there's tremendous argument that goes back and forth, fighting that goes back and forth. Here comes Catherine of Siena.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'll talk a little bit more about her in a bit, but she even at this point offered to negotiate a settlement between the Pope and the city of Florence.
Wow.
It would have been a good move to do. Gregory mm-hmm. should have accepted it. Instead, what he did was he sent one of his cardinals down in order to bring about peace. And this particular cardinal, he's known as, his name is Cardinal Robert of Geneva.
Okay.
We'll see him again. Anyway, when he arrives, he decides the best answer is a military answer.
Mm.
And what he did was he hired a whole bunch of English mercenaries, several hundred English mercenaries, and they laid siege to Florence. They were not able to break in, and so what they did was they made an example out of one small town nearby. That's the town of Cesena.
Okay.
Now, Cesena is the same place that Michael of Cesena.
Michael of Cesena,
remember,
right,
he was the Franciscan master general.
Uh-huh.
And he's from that town. Of course, he's been dead now a number of years.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, the British the English mercenaries appear. Robert then takes them, has them attack the town of Cesena and butcher everybody.
Oh, my.
And he's ever since then was known as the Butcher of Cesena.
Okay.
This is in June of 1374. It is not a happy moment in church history. Ultimately, the papal army was made up of some 10,000, what was known at the time as the condottieri. These are mercenaries under contract. It's just, they're uncontrollable. Well, Catherine decides to take matters in her own hand, too.
Okay.
You know, she is the 25th child in that family. Talk about a
25 big children.
Yeah, yeah. Her father was from Tuscany.
Okay.
He was a wool dyer, and it's I just marvel at it. 25 children.
25 children, and his father's a wool dyer.
I wouldn't think
that would be a terribly high-paying position.
I wouldn't think so, but I imagine they all
they did in well,
some one way or another. Anyway, she decided to set out for Avignon to convince the Pope to come back. And this was not an easy thing for her to do, considering that she did not speak Latin,
speak
French. Yes, she's a woman. Although there are outstanding women in church history in the Middle Ages, as well as any other time, that catch the eye and the ear of everybody. And we had our own Mother Teresa within our own century, but you know, when you think about Catherine of Siena, a contemporary is... Bridget of Sweden.
Yes.
Hildegard of Bingen is around that same, a little bit earlier, about that same time. Tremendous influence. So don't discount the fact.
No, my thought was more on how safe was travel for a woman at this time.
Yeah, it would not have been. She, in fact, traveled with her confessor.
Okay, that was my. That was really more my thought was.
Yeah.
How did she get from one place to the other, not in what she was able to do.
Yeah, but actually, to tell you the truth, her reputation was so strong that her confessor, Raymond of Capua, who eventually was canonized, Raymond of Capua was probably protected by her rather than the other way around. There are so many stories and legends of her mystical power. There's one rather gross story of her meeting a man who was suffering from the bubonic plague, which, of course, is a terrible thing, and huge pus accumulation,
system.
You know. Yeah,
in the
groin area and the underneath the armpits. And the story goes that she lanced one of the armpits, and out came all this pus. And now remember, this is very fatal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
She then kissed the lance, and the man was cured of the plague.
Wow.
And, you know, whether that actually happened or not, it's a wonderful legend, but whether it actually happened or not, people believe that it happened.
Uh-huh.
And what impressed them was the fact that this woman was able to kiss a bleeding pulchral from the bubonic plague and survive.
She lived, right?
She lived.
Not only him being healed,
lived. So where she went, she was respected. You know?
Yes.
And so she made her way to Italy, to Avignon, but she needed to rely on Raymond of Capua to be her translator because she spoke only a Tuscan form of Italian, very early Italian. Well, when she gets to Avignon, as you can imagine, she made a sensation. She was the talk of the place. One of the first things she did when she met the Pope was she reminded him of his vow to return to Rome during his pontificate. That's called a stir. And the reason was that the vow that he made was a secret vow to only a few of the cardinals. She knew about that, and yet it had never gotten out.
Okay.
She also... She also reported to the Pope all of the sins of the priests at Avignon and the entourage at the papal court.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, she named names and named sins. And Gregory's response was, how did you learn so much in such a short period of time? And the historians record her response to the Pope, and I'd just like to read it directly.
Oh, please.
Yeah. She says, to the glory of Almighty God, I am bound to say that I smelt the stench of sins which flourish in the papal court while I was still at home in my own town, more sharply than those who have practiced them and do practice them every day here.
Wow.
Well, yeah, that's for sure. There's a story, and it's mentioned in several histories. So I don't think this is legend, but there's a story in which she was at one time, after having received communion at Mass, she went into an ecstasy, and Mass ended. Everyone left the chapel, and she was still in ecstasy. And the story goes that the nephew of one of the popes, his wife, came into the chapel, and she wanted to test Catherine. And so what she did was she took a sewing needle and she stabbed Catherine's foot
Okay.
And there was no response.
Uh-huh.
No response at all. And so she withdrew the needle and then left.
Uh-huh.
And nobody said anything about anything, but evidently had done such harm to Catherine's foot that she was not able to stand on it for several days. She didn't know why, and nobody said.
Oh my goodness!
Within the chronicles of this period, this is a story that, as I say, has been corroborated by several historians. Catherine, through things like this, won over a lot of the cardinals and won over the inquisitors, and particularly. Charmed was one cardinal in particular from Spain. His name is Cardinal Pedro de Luna. We'll be talking a lot about him next week.
Okay.
I am convinced, looking at his biography, that that he would have made a great pope. In fact, he thought he was pope, but
okay.
Well, that's a whole other question. He was one of the anti-popes, but would have made a great pope. I'm sorry for that. Another individual that she very much impressed while at Avignon was the Bishop of Bari in Italy. He himself was young, a reformer. His name was Bartolomeo Prignani, and we'll see Prignano, and we'll see him a little bit later on. But he was already within his own diocese, reforming the diocese, and a very holy man.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very much impressed with Catherine and the need for the Pope to come back. Around this same time, there is also word from a Franciscan mystic in Spain. His name is Pedro of Aragon, that warns the Pope that he must return to Italy or he will die. So he's getting some pretty good signals that something better happen, and he's feeling this himself. More and more he's talking about returning. More and more the cardinals are talking about this is a good idea until they saw him start to pack. And then some of the cardinals said, I don't want to do this. And he said, I'm going. You can either go with me or not. The whole entourage then basically packed up from Avignon. And this was on September 13th of 1376. The stories of the crying and the wailing of the people of Avignon and the whole area of Avignon Provence as he made his way down the river, the Rhone, and each of the boats, the papal boats as they were going, and people waving goodbye and knowing that they would never see him again. It was just very sad, you know, for these people who for 70 years had hosted the Pope.
Right.
You know. However, as soon as they got to see, a lot of them had second thoughts. As they were traveling down the Mediterranean, down toward Ostia, outside of Rome, the port of Rome, there were two terrible storms. Two ships were lost at sea.
Mm.
Some life was lost also. And finally they arrived on the banks of the Tiber River on the 17th of January of 1377.
Okay.
Okay. As much as the people of Provence had cried to see the Pope leave, the people of Rome cried at the joy of the return of the Pope to his city.
Mm-hmm.
There were bands, there were parades, there were groups of dancers. It was just all the way to Rome. There was this wonderful festivity. There were also a lot of troops, soldiers of Raymond of Turin. This becomes important to the story later on.
Okay.
Because the story is going to be that Rome had turned ruckus and dangerous again, and that's not entirely true, but I'll talk. I'm jumping ahead a little bit.
Okay.
Anyway, Gregory arrives back in Rome. Well, arrives in Rome. He'd never been there before.
Right.
He arrives in Rome. The travel has taken a toll on most of the cardinals and the entourage, but especially on the Pope.
Mm-hmm.
He never quite recovered.
Okay.
And it turns out that as the summer goes of 1377, it was a particularly hot and brutal summer in Rome. We have to remember that there is this North African wind that comes up that goes all the way through North Africa into Malta and over into Italy and sweeps its way up the Italian, the western side of Italy. It's called the Sirocco.
Oh.
And this can be brutal. if you find yourself in Rome during the summer and you happen to get hit by this North African wind, it is really something. And you can imagine in the 1300s, they didn't exactly have air conditioners.
Right.
And so the Pope took sick, and throughout the winter of 1377, 1378, he just barely hung on. And then on March 27th, right before Easter, he died.
Oh.
In 1378. His last words were, "I should never have left Avignon."
Oh, no.
And that darn Catherine ensnarled me with her infatuated visions.
Wow.
Well, tough. You know,
right,
there they were.
Right.
What happens now is really open to debate. And there are two points of view on this. There's one group that follows an historian, by his name is Marziah Gale. And I'm going to tell you his story first because it's the more exciting story.
Okay.
But it's not entirely true.
Oh, okay.
And then the other, which really I found as I read various histories of this period, is best told by a 19th century French historian.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Salambrier. And he was a professor of church history at Catholic University of Lille in France in the 1800s. But he really tells the story, I think, most scientifically. He works with just our facts. Okay. Anyway, this whole what follows after the death of Gregory is called the Fateful Conclave.
Why did they call it that?
It's called that because it was such a disaster. This conclave ends up with a pope who people really questioned whether or not he had received a legitimate election.
Okay.
And then a whole group of cardinals leave Rome, form their own conclave, and they anathematize him, and he anathematizes them, and the end result is you have the split of the church into two factions.
Give us a little instruction. How can they question whether or not he's the Pope? What question could there be?
That's a good question in itself. And the answer to that is duress.
Okay.
If you follow Gale's understanding of the events that take place, it is pretty clear that the cardinals elected this Pope, Urban VI, elected him out of fear for their lives. And therefore it was an illegitimate election.
I see.
If you follow Salambrier, on the other hand, you see that it was a pretty riotous operation, but that nobody was actually in mortal danger.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was not an election under duress.
Okay.
So it depends on your point
of view.
So
that would be the indication, really, of whether or not it was under duress.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, really.
Okay.
And those troops that I mentioned before, those troops that were involved in the parade,
right,
are an important aspect of that because they could be called upon, if necessary, to establish martial law in Rome.
Oh, okay.
Okay. They they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that.
Okay. So let's take the exciting,
let's get into this.
First. Okay. And the story goes like this, and it's got an element of truth. That's what makes it.
Yeah, well, everything has to, right?
Yeah, that's right. And so you have the conclave forming on April 7th of 1378.
Okay.
Okay. There is a mob, a Roman mob of some 20,000 people, and as the cardinals are attempting to come into the Vatican compound, they are jostled by this huge mob, and some of them had their cardinal's rings ripped right off their hands.
Oh, my gosh.
And one, the Bishop of Marseille, who was the master of the conclave, was knocked to the ground and mauled by these people. And when he got up, the keys were missing. And so he didn't have the keys to lock the chambers where the conclave was going to be. And so they had no protection. This is just terrible. Well, they all withdrew to the second floor, to an apartment there, and one door was bricked up so that no one could get in.
Okay.
And the other door was locked with huge beams placed over the
mm-hmm.
door. Okay. And all night long, they heard the shouting of the mobs outside, outside the apartment, shouting out, "Romano o Italiano lo valoma." Elect a Roman or an Italian. And they also shouted out, "If you don't give us a Roman, we'll kill you all."
Okay.
Around 8 o'clock that night, 16 cardinals gathered into the chapel. And among them was Robert of Geneva.
Okay.
And he was so petrified, we know this for a fact, that he actually wore chainmail armor underneath his...
Wow.
I mean, that's the 14th century Kevlar vest.
Right.
Yeah, you know? And so he actually wore armor in order to protect himself. In the midst of all of this, a delegation of the Roman mob broke in into the apartment.
Chapel? Okay.
They broke open the chapel and they broke in and they said elect us a Roman or at least an Italian or die. And one of the cardinals tried to reason with them and said that if you force us to vote this way, it'll be under duress. It would be an illegitimate pope. Well, the next morning, they gathered again for the vote, and it turned out that there was an impasse. You had 7 French votes going in one direction and 5 anti-votes going in the other direction. And the mob was again surging in, and so somebody suggested that they elect an Italian, none other than Bartolomeo Prignano, the Archbishop of Bari, the reformer. Mm-hmm. And but by now the crowd was at the doors and they were actually hatcheting the doors trying to break in, and now here's the story goes, okay, and then it was lunchtime.
Okay.
The story starts breaking down a little bit.
It sounds like it might.
So anyway, they took a midday brunch.
With the doors being hatcheted down. Okay.
And then after they came back from lunch. The crowd demanded to know if there had been a vote, and some servant shouted out one of the windows, Bari. But the crowd thought that he said Baro, and Baro was a French bishop, Jean de Baro. And so they attacked again, and someone found a passageway out, and so the cardinals slithered out a ladder and fled to get out of this conclave, and the others on the way out asked one of the old cardinals to stay behind. He was an Italian, in fact, he was a Roman, and this is Cardinal Tibaldeschi, and asked him to stay behind and pretend he was the Pope. And so on the way out, they rang the papal bell. This is before they burned.
Mm-hmm,
okay.
The
white and the black smoke.
Smoke, right.
They rang the Pope's bell, and they all sang the Te Deum real fast, and then got out, and the crowd went quiet. And when they finally broke in, there is Cardinal Tibaldeschi sitting there wearing the tiara, and they knelt down before him, and he cried out, "This is a farce. How can I be a pope?" And the crowd goes, "Well, then who is pope?" And he hollers out, "The Archbishop of Bari." And there was a riot that followed afterwards.
Okay.
And some of the cardinals fled and got out of town. And others ran to the Castle San Angelo, you know, the round Hadrian cylinder. Actually, it was a whole castle at the time. And they hid in there. And then guards went and they found Bartolomeo, went to his residence. And they told him that he had been elected pope. And he said, "I don't think so. Round up the cardinals and let's have another election." And most of the others refused to come. And eventually they convinced the cardinals that were in San Angelo Castle that if they had an escort, a military escort, they would come and then have another vote. And eventually 6 of them, under military protection, left the Castle of San Angelo, made their way back to the conclave, and there the Archbishop of Bari was there, kissed each one of them. The city went quiet when they found out that, in fact, it was Bari's election, that an Italian had been elected. A couple days later, this is all happening right before Holy Week.
Okay.
Okay, they go through Holy Week, and on Easter Sunday afternoon, he is coronated by Cardinal Orsini of Milan. There is a procession, there is a feast, and now taking the title Urban VI at this feast, he sits down and drinks 8 beakers of wine and gets drunk. And the guard, the captain of the guard, is recorded as saying the following: "When I saw him there at that table, I said to myself, 'You now have before you combined in one person all the devils of hell.'" That was the last banquet that was held in Rome. And after that, the Pope was very, very strict as to how he dealt with his own household and how he dealt with the cardinals.
Okay.
Well, what happened then was many of the cardinals, for fear of their lives, escaped. And they got out of Rome and they began writing to all the monarchs of Europe, telling them what a terrible thing had happened, and that this man who is now sitting on the throne of Peter is not actually the Pope, but rather he's illegitimate. And while at outside of Rome in the town of Fondi, they gathered and they elected a new man as Pope, and that's going to be none other than Robert of Geneva, who takes the title of Pope Clement. And he, in August of 1378, he and the other French cardinals anathematize Urban.
Okay.
And at the same time, he does the same. And also, he brings in troops. He asks the Queen of Naples, Queen Joanna.
Urban brings
in troops. You've got 200 cavalry for the French cardinals and Clement the anti-Pope Clement VII, and now these ground troops, these infantry arrive in order to bolster the Roman Pope. Okay, and now that is Mirzaya Gale's version of what happened.
Okay.
Okay, and a lot there's certain elements that are actually true in all of that, but it's not the whole story.
So what are the holes?
Okay, and there's some good holes. Yeah,
there's got to be holes there.
Yeah,
especially that lunch break is just a little.
You caught that, did you? Well, Salambrier in his book in which
he commercially.
This, yeah. He writes a book. This is in the late 19th century. The title of it is The Great Schism of the West.
Okay.
It's out of print, but it's still available. And it is probably the single most accurate thing for us. And he points out that if the cardinals were, in fact, in fear of their lives, why did they go to Rome to begin with? You know, they might have stayed in Avignon, or for that matter, after reaching Ostia, they might have been afraid, and they would not have gone to Rome. Or if they had gone to Rome, why didn't they use those troops that had, Raymond's troops, that had been available? They were right there on the road to Ostia. They were part of the parade, and these were true military troops, so they certainly could have used those. This guy did his homework. And he found out that not only did you have those troops, but also in the vicinity at the time of the conclave, there were some 500 condottieri from Breton in France, and these guys were for hire, so they could have hired them, you know, as mercenaries, armed guards. Mm-hmm. You know, they could have hired them. That would have been 500. These guys are professionals.
Mm-hmm.
That would have made a difference too. Also, there is no mention of the garrison that's in Castel San Angelo. Gale does mention the captain of that garrison, a man by the name of Pierre Gandolin. Now, Gandolin is the one who makes the statement that he saw Urban drunk and all this kind of stuff. But we don't know where that source actually came from.
Okay.
And whether it was Gandolin who actually said it or someone who used his name later on in order to besmirch the name of Urban the Sixth.
Mm-hmm.
That might be too.
Mm-hmm.
But he does have a garrison in Castel San Angelo, and that could have been used also. Not only that, but he points out that there were there's an organization known as the Bannerets of the Roman districts. They're sort of like police. Remember, they don't have police back in those days the same way we do. But these were people who were that served in the same function of
keeping order.
Keeping order, law and order in their particular Roman districts. they were available. Not only that, but you also had a militia. Mm-hmm. The Roman nobles, the young nobles of Rome, were members of a city militia that could have been used also. They didn't have that. We do know, as Salabrier points out, that before the Pope arrived, just in order to make right before the conclave, to make sure that everyone understood that there would be law and order in Rome, we know for a fact that the prefect of Rome, basically the mayor, had sent the Roman executioners into the largest plaza in the city of Rome, which is the Piazza of St. Peter's. Mm-hmm. It's not the one that we know today.
Right.
Okay, but it's an earlier one. And that they do this every once in a while. What they do is they send the executioners in, and then they have tables set out, and they show everybody their little tools of their trade.
Okay.
And it's like, you really don't want to...
Don't mess with us.
Don't mess with us.
Have.
That's right. And you know, there's a wide range of stuff. When we think of executioners, we think of people who put people to death. But in fact, what you're doing is you're executing a judgment against someone. And so in some cases, it might... this not nice, but it might be things like cropping ears.
Mm.
So you're going to have a scissors there, and you show people how you cut off the lobe of someone's ear. You could also crop someone's nose, which is to set a scissors up, you can imagine, up a nostril and then cut that. There's another famous little instrument called a Mundbirna, a mouth pear. It looks like a pear, but it's metal. And you stick it into somebody, the fat end, you stick it into their mouth. And on the thin end is a little key. And you turn the key, and the fat end expands in the mouth. There are all kinds of fancy little techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was an opportunity for the people of Rome to see what was awaiting them if they were disorderly.
Okay.
You know, this, in fact, did happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so we know that the authorities in Rome were expecting trouble, and they could have responded with whatever force was necessary in order to protect the cardinals.
Right.
Okay. We know that the cardinals arrived, and we know that, and Salabrier points out, that there was a crowd of about 20,000 people. Okay, and they were shouting. At least what he was saying was that what they were shouting was, "Romano lo volemo o almeno italiano." Now my Italian's terrible, but the best I could figure is, vote for a Roman or at least an Italian. Now we have to look at the makeup of the conclave, which is something that Marzaiah Gales does not do.
Mm-hmm.
And the conclave itself is not monolithic. You have among the cardinals, you have four Italian cardinals,
okay,
four French cardinals, one Spanish cardinal, that's Pedro de Luna, okay, and you also have five other cardinals that are almost always lumped together with the French, which would give them a 9-5
mm-hmm.
majority,
mm-hmm.
but these guys are actually from the area of Aquitaine, and they're known as Limousin. And if you remember, these guys are actually under the leadership of the King of England. Remember that France is broken up into many different parts,
mm-hmm.
and that so while they speak French and you would consider them today to be Frenchmen, their political loyalty was to the King of England.
Mm-hmm.
And they were considered to be traitors among other Frenchmen. Remember, the Hundred Years' War is involved in all of this. And then there were two other cardinals that are just sort of on the side. I won't go into that. Anyway, this is the group that comes together. And what you do find is that there is an alliance of the four Italians and the four French and the one Spaniard, so that means nine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the one thing that they stood for was that there would not be another Gascon or Limousin pope. And several of the popes and the Avignon popes had in fact been from that part of France. In fact, Bishop Robert of Geneva, the
mm-hmm.
butcher of Cesena,
mm-hmm.
is quoted as saying, "This time we will have an Italian. I will never vote for those Limousin traitors, Okay. Now, what you might think of him is one question, but the fact of the matter is, this is a quote from this man before the conclave began. In other words, there was already a movement toward electing an Italian.
Italian. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The cardinals gathered on the 7th of April. Okay, everyone agrees to that. There were a few Romans who found their way into the Vatican, despite the fact that the doors had been bricked up. So, that's factual, too. Those who came in belonged to a group called the Caporioni, and they represented the city districts. They were sort of like aldermen.
Okay.
So these are, this isn't a mob. These are like the aldermen coming in. And they appeared before the cardinals, and they begged the cardinals to vote for an Italian pope. At that point, one of the cardinals told them that their request was inappropriate and they must leave. Thereupon, they left. It's a little different from the story that we'd heard before. That night, it was a loud one. There was a lot of stuff going on in the streets. It sort of like looked like or sounded like Mardi Gras in New Orleans. Okay. part of the reason for that was that somebody found out how to get into the palace cellars.
Oops.
A lot of the Avignon popes, the Avignon pope and the Avignon bishops, cardinals, did not want to leave their precious wine behind. Remember, this is some of the best wine in the world.
Burgundy and
Burgundy, the Bordeaux, all this, and they brought it with them. There were two ugly discoveries in the midst of all of this. The first discovery was that it was all gone because the Italians broke in, the Romans broke in and drank a lot of it. The other, which was probably even more shocking and disconcerting to these French cardinals, was that Bordeaux at that time did not travel well. And so if you taste it near home, it's a very wonderful wine. By the time it got down to Italy, it was just table wine. And so it was another good reason to go back home, you can imagine. Anyway, the winery is plundered. The cellar is plundered. You got a lot of people running around, late night, all this kind of stuff. Early the next morning on
probably
April.
Probably not capable of fighting too much.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I would hope not. April 8th, the cardinals wake up. They celebrate Mass together. And while they're celebrating Mass, the city alarm bell is rung. A huge crowd assembles. Cardinal Pedro de Luna calls for a vote shortly after the Mass. There is a crowd coming, and they want an answer, and they figured that we better do this. So they had a couple votes. They could not get a majority. It's basically the Italian, French, Spanish block against the Limousine block. And what happens then is that he suggests, Cardinal Pedro de Luna, suggests that they go outside of the cardinals and find a good bishop and elect him. And so at this point, one of the French cardinals declared, he said, I vote for Prignani as Roman pontiff. And one after another, the cardinals began agreeing. A few hesitated. One in particular, Cardinal Orsini of Milan, a young man who we learn later on had aspirations to become pope himself, said that he couldn't vote for anybody right now because he felt physically threatened. All the other cardinals go, come on, But it just, anyway, a vote's taken around 9 o'clock in the morning. They vote for the Archbishop of Bari and then say, now we've got to keep this quiet until he arrives and accepts. And so they sent a courier off because they knew where he was staying in Rome, and so they waited for his reply. They wait all throughout the morning, and lunch comes. This is the famous lunch.
Lunch break again.
And they all took their lunch break, and so did the crowd.
Okay.
But probably they are pretty hungover and hungry by this time, too. By 1 o'clock, there's new excitement going on. Once again, they come back together, and they said, well, they began questioning themselves. Now, 13 of the 16 cardinals were there. Three of the cardinals were gone. 13 of the 16 go, did we just have a conclave, and did we elect the Archbishop of Bari? And I said, yeah. But Orsini said he was under duress. Now, he's not there right now. Did anyone else feel under duress? Well, I don't know. Well, let's just re-elect him. And so they had a second vote.
Okay.
And they elected him 13. There are 13 there. He won 13 votes.
Okay.
There are three who were not there,
mm-hmm.
Orsini being one of those. And so Orsini was there. But 13 of them were there. Three of them were absent doing something else. And in the midst of all of this, then, Cardinal Orsini comes back. He had been away. He comes back after the vote takes place. He's afraid that the crowds are panicking again. He goes to the window and shouts out, and I don't know why. He shouts out to the people, "You have a pope. It's Cardinal Tishbaldeschi." Well, I don't know why, but he did. And the rumor went around Rome that he was lying in order to save his skin. Remember, Tibaldeschi is a Roman.
Okay.
Okay, a Roman cardinal. And so maybe that's why he did it, was just to buy time. But what actually happens is the rumor gets going that John of Barrow, remember that
mm-hmm,
Frenchman,
the Frenchman,
had been elected. And so the crowds break into the conclave. They break windows. Several of the conclave members are manhandled. This actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
And Cardinal Tibaldeschi protests and hollers out, "I am not the Pope, it is the Archbishop of Bari." Right around that time, the Archbishop of Bari arrives at the Vatican. By now, most of the cardinals have run away.
Okay.
Now the crowd sees who, in fact, was elected the new Pope. And this is going to be Pope Urban VI.
Uh-huh.
He is an Italian, and things begin to quiet down.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay.
With that, here's poor the Archbishop of Bari, Prignano, by himself in a trashed room, and all of a sudden the Cardinal of Florence arrives and is with him.
Okay.
Then Cardinal Orsini of Milan arrives, and then one after another, one of the French cardinals convinces five of the cardinals who had been at Castel San Angelo to come and join him also. A couple others came. Pedro de Luna came, and so they all rallied around him, assuring him that, in fact, they had elected him Pope. On Easter Sunday, he was coronated. The tiara was placed on his head by Cardinal Orsini, the only man that had not voted for him,
right,
as a way of showing his obedience to the new Pope.
Okay.
He takes the title of Urban VI. Okay. The question is Urban VI really the Pope or not? And I think you'd have to say,
looking at that,
the real facts that take place, is, in fact, he is the Pope.
Without a doubt, it seems,
yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, if that's true then...
Mm-hmm.
Then why did these other French cardinals go to Fondi and hold a second conclave? And the answer to that is in the character of Urban VI.
Okay.
Sometimes people change.
Mm-hmm.
And this is exactly what happened to him. It is one of the most extraordinary changes in history. But, you know, we know, for instance, Warren G. Harding, President of the United States, was a scoundrel before he walked into the Oval Office. And he really tried to clean up his act. People change.
Right.
And under certain circumstances. In the case of Urban VI, he changed. He had led a diocese toward reform. He lived a very simple life. Personal mortifications. He was a patron of literature, the arts. He was schooled in law. He was a prudent man. He was experienced. He had been a bishop for 15 years. All of a sudden, he changed overnight, became incredibly zealous toward reforming the church top down.
Okay.
If you remember, we had a couple examples of this earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Benedict XII, for instance, changing reforming the church from the top down.
Right.
He took all the sternness of Benedict XII and applied it to the cardinals.
Okay.
He took the zeal that his predecessor, Gregory XI, had had, mm-hmm, in routing out heresy, and now he begins to rout out sinfulness within his own household.
Mm-hmm.
And so he is inflexible. He's passionate about what he's doing. Catherine of Siena even has a letter sent to him saying, "Cool it.
Oh.
You're losing your support."
Okay.
We
are running short on time here, Father. Can we
close well,
a little bit and carry through this next week?
I'm sorry?
Can we close with a little bit?
Yeah, certainly we could do that.
Okay.
I think we're at the point now where we can see that this breakdown is taking place.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll take a look at the Western Schism full-blown then next week.
Okay. Well, would you close today for us?
Sure. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be,
world without end.
Amen.
Thank you, Father.